is the Grinnion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinnion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grinnion bunker, my friends, you know what time it is? It's your weekly one-stop shop for the weird and the unusual. I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Grinnion Report. Welcome to the program. I tell you, it's always so good, such an honor, privilege, and pleasure to be right here behind this, well, platinum-clad microphone, hundreds of miles beneath terra firma down here in the Mohorovic discontinuity. My engineer, the man with the plan, pushing all the right buttons, Mr. Caleb Hanks, joins us live in studio. Caleb, how are you?
I'm great, Micah. How are you doing?
I thought you were Caleb. Wait a minute.
Stop the joke. The shtick is killing me.
Tyler Pittman. Good evening, Tyler. How are you?
Good evening. I'm just noshing on some BT maize.
Yeah, well, you know what? You're going to be noshing on something else here in just a minute because we're going to be talking about this. What do they call this thing? Well, they call it the Monsanto Protection Act. Its opponents do, at very least.
The Naha Protection Act?
It's officially called the Farmer Assurance Provision. And then, of course, during hour two, we're going to get into some fun stuff. I always like to play audio on this program, creepy-sounding audio. And we'll be talking about electronic voice phenomenon tonight on the Grinnion Report, so you don't want to miss that. Be sure and stick around. For all you podcast listeners out there who... Oh, you're just too good to join us live. No, that's okay. I was talking with my buddies Jay and Kay over at Jay and Kay After Dark yesterday. Another fine podcast that operates from its own bunker in its own dark disquiet out there in a dark corner of the web that's similar to us but not the same as the Grinnion Bunker. And we were talking about podcasting being an art unto itself, you know. I think that there are benefits both to broadcast radio and then also to, of course, what we know as podcasting. I like them both, and there's a little to be learned from both kinds. So, you know, the podcast listeners, you know, I think it's what's cool about podcasting these days is even the radio people now offer their programs as podcasts. And I would probably be willing to wager that there are more people out there who would take even mainstream radio programs, big-time listenership stuff, carry it around and listen to it on the go because it's just more convenient to do it like that. So, you know, however you prefer to listen, we're glad you're here. Welcome to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grinnion Report. We're always glad to hear from you just as well, and I always invite you to share your own comments, questions, criticisms, critiques, or whatever else with us, info@grinnionreport.com. And we have a couple of people who wrote in this week. We'll get to that right away. Terrence writes in, "Hey, Grinnion gang, listening to the latest episode and wanted to chime in about the robot rights topic that you brought up. Will robots eventually have rights just like humans once we begin to institute artificial intelligences? Will they have rights similar to what Caleb or Tyler or I would have, or anyone else for that matter?
What if I am one by then?"
Yeah, well, you know, there may be bizarre combinations of human android hybrids and things.
It's called a cyborg.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's the thing, is there are going to be a lot of questions on down the road. So Tyler, or rather, I'm sorry, Terrence brings this up. I'm sure Tyler would probably talk about it as well.
Indeed. Watson got to keep his prize money, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, to build another Watson.
Yes, yes. Self-replicating nanobots. But I digress. So Terrence says, you guys brought that up. Well, I have to go ahead and drop my crazy conspiracy alert. We need a crazy conspiracy alert button of some sort.
I can put one of those together.
Terrence says, "I think it's interesting to connect these dots. Drone programs are being moved to Pentagon control. Pentagon is reported to want to develop a self-teaching AI of some variety. A robotic cloud network is being developed called Raputya, which would also allow robots the ability to share information via Wi-Fi software. And I don't think it's too far out, or too far of a stretch even, to think at some point, if all these things come together, we could have a real-world Skynet, just like what we see in the Terminator films. Pentagon developers, and of course the Pentagon developing artificial intelligence, well, they become aware of the Raputya, or whatever this program is, and then they gain access because it could, in theory, you know, break code even faster than any human could. And then it learns how to arm and control drones. Well, Raputya shares GPS and personal information with all AI drones, and boom, just like dynamite. What if it gets aware of nukes just as well? I mean, we could be talking about all-out robot war. So Terrence suggests, it reminds me a little of that book, Failsafe, that Dr. Strangelove was based on, the film, if you remember. I'm not sure that there are precautions in place to prevent that, and a lot of it depends on how fast or even if that AI program becomes active and how widely Rapputia is used. I'm not sure I am pronouncing that word correctly because it's a new term. I'll have to get on the jargon watch and learn a bit more about this because, well, I'll just have to say I've been colored intrigued. I'm not my usual grayly and green anymore. As a matter of fact, if we ever have our own coffee, I think I told Caleb we're going to have to call it the green bean. Or if it were like these robots, it'd be the mean bean, wouldn't it, right?
Yeah.
Billy, one of our correspondents in Germany, writes, Hanks, what do you think about this? And then he linked to a story we're going to touch on here in just a moment. The Monsanto story. In other words, the farmer assurance provision. Yeah, I've got some thoughts that I'd like to share about that, and we'll talk about it here in just a moment. Billy says, I have to say this is just another of the many reasons that politics depresses me. It also worries me greatly that this sort of thing happens so easily in the States. I often think that the U.S. is just too big, and maybe people struggle to get together in enough numbers and quickly enough to oppose this sort of thing, or at least to have a proper debate before things are signed into law. I've often said that, you know, one of the biggest problems of the United States is that it is so large. And this is one of the reasons why, initially, the idea was state sovereignty. Each state operates unto itself. But, you know, federal law, I'm not saying that big government is always, okay, mostly bad, I think. But there are some, well, okay, I'll have to think about it. But for the most part, big government these days is pretty bad. And when you have wide-reaching federal powers, a lot of the time, things that are important to an individual in one small locality, okay, versus someone on the other side of the continental United States, you know, based on demographic, culture, climate, you know, all different sorts of things. The values aren't always the same, and sometimes, you know, one great big cookie-cutter idea to fit them all is not necessarily the best thing. So, yeah, I've wondered about the same thing, Billy. He says, I'm sure it happens in the UK as well to a lesser extent, but I'd like to think that politicians in the UK find it much harder to get away with misleading the public as they have less hiding place when the Brits aren't hindered by patriotism nonsense that politicians in the U.S. typically hide behind. Not that patriotism is bad, but they claim that that's what's motivating them when really there's a lot more going on. So what exactly is Billy talking about here? This is the email that that was sent to me. The International Business Times first carried the story. Our friend John Greenwald over at the Black Vault picked it up, and a number of other sites did just as well. And it has to do with the farmer assurance provision, okay? What opponents are calling the Monsanto Protection Act. It was passed just, I guess, within the last few days. Now, the story is President Barack Obama signed a spending bill, House Resolution 933, into law. And this was on, I guess, last Tuesday. It includes language that has food and consumer advocates and organic farmers up in arms over their contention that the so-called Monsanto Protection Act is a giveaway to corporations, and it was passed under the cover of darkness. Folks, how often does this... People don't think that there are conspiracies. Maybe they don't have to be conspiracies, but there's a lot of shady dealings in Washington in terms of how these sorts of stories... Okay, or rather, how these sorts of pieces of legislation are actually passed into law. If it's not put out on the floor and voted on by people outright, they'll tuck it away and hide it inside an emergency, you know, spending bill or something like that, and they'll paint everybody who says or questions anything else in that spending bill as being unpatriotic if they vote against it because the greater whole is of greater importance. In other words, if we've got all this, you know, emergency spending, if it has to do with, you know, foreign wars, if it has to do with economic bailouts or emergencies and things like that, they'll tuck anything that they want to in there and tell everybody that it's basically a mandatory vote. No, they don't have to, but they're going to be ridiculed. And of course, yes, there is this patriotism, a kind of faux patriotism that comes into question. So politicians feel that they have to vote for these kinds of things, and sneakily, such things as the farmer assurance provision are passed into law.
Pork barrel crap.
Well, I mean, pork barrel's really bringing money home to your constituencies, you know. And that's the big thing is, you know, even guys like Ron Paul, although he has defended the allegations that he is also a pork barrel spender, you know, even Ron Paul, who's talked about not taking federal funding, has tried to get federal funding for his constituents in Texas, you know. But then again, you know, he's stood up and defended that, and there are even some people who, after taking money that's been appropriated for such things, they even give it back to the government. Doesn't happen often, but some people do try and put their money where their mouth is on that. But yeah, it's a little different. Anyway, about this farmer assurance provision, okay, there's a lot being said about it, but there are five things that the International Business Times put out, five terrifying things about this. Section 735 of the spending bill. Okay, and these will get you acquainted with the reasons why people are so upset about this, and of course why our field correspondent, Billy, the Englishman in Germany, who was recently, I believe, in New York with a couple of Irishmen. Gosh, boy, this gets really confusing. But this is why he was asking me about it and why our conspiracy alert went off. Number one, the Monsanto Protection Act, and again, that's a tongue-in-cheek title, but just like Obamacare or anything else, a popular term that's appended to a political item or a piece of legislation, you're going to hear people calling it the Monsanto Protection Act and why it's important to Graylian listeners. It effectively bars federal courts from being able to halt the sale or planting of controversial genetically modified or genetically engineered seeds, no matter what health issues may arise concerning GMOs and their use in the future. Now, the advent of genetically modified seeds, which a lot of people aren't really comfortable with, which has been driven by the massive Monsanto company, and their exploding use in farms across America came on fast and has proved a huge boon for Monsanto's profits. Now, I was on a program last night, and the host, Chip Plesher, was saying to me, you know, maybe the idea behind creating genetically modified, food stuff wasn't entirely evil. Maybe the idea was that we're going to be dealing with scarcity in a few years, and the idea was that we need to be able to reliably produce food and be able to do it more quickly. So in one way of looking at this, some might assert that this is actually intended to aid problems, either existing or expected to come with regard to scarcity. But then there's also the potential that, for instance, such technologies as genetically engineering seeds so that they kind of have a, what would you call it? I guess, you know, a built-in kill switch. You know, they don't reproduce after a couple of generations. And then you have to go back to companies like Monsanto and buy these things as opposed to the old methods where you're able to plant a seed in the ground. And, of course, the crop bears fruit each year. That's rendered essentially obsolete. So would it actually, if these kinds of technologies were utilized, would it contribute to more scarcity? There is a bit of a problem here, but again, this is not something that people are, well, I think a lot of people are aware of it, and of course, even everyone from George Norrie to Alex Jones, they'll jump up and down and then talk about it. But by the same token, it doesn't seem that anything in Washington is really being done about this, and again, it slipped into a spending bill and passed into law at like, what, 3 o'clock in the morning? Wasn't it 3 o'clock in the morning? Something like that?
Was usually 3 o'clock in the morning our time, so around midnight Pacific.
Yeah, I mean, it's always like that. They always wait until the wee hours of the morning. Everybody's tired. They've been up all night. Okay, we don't care anymore. Just go ahead and just sign the damn thing into law so we can go home and go to sleep.
So are Alex Jones seeds organic? His survival seeds?
Well, they're not his, I guess. You know, it's a sponsor. But
who is he buying
from? The idea is, that people who are against this sort of legislation that would allow protection for genetically modified seeds are advocates of, as I am, organic seeds, seeds that haven't been tampered with.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Good old natural seeds. Now, I'm not saying that technology is bad, but I am saying that I don't know that we need to bring laws into effect that basically protect people who are working with genetically modified foodstuff, and they don't know what the long-term repercussions may be. Okay, number two, the provision's language was apparently, get this, written in collusion with Monsanto. Lawmakers and companies working together to craft legislation is by no means a rare occurrence in this day and age. Let's just look at a couple of other examples here, folks. Caleb and Tyler and I were talking about this before we took the airwaves. Just a few years ago, what was it? I guess it was the DREAM Act, which basically granted, well, it was intended to be able to keep certain special interests out of Washington. But what ended up happening, of course, is that the largest special interest groups, among them the NRA, were actually kept. They were actually basically granted immunity. And one of the very people who argued for that was right here in North Carolina, Heath Shuler, congressman. Happened to be a Democrat, but also one of the few Democrats who had gotten a, guess what, an endorsement from the NRA. And so often lawmakers will work out special exclusivities for special interest groups and people if it benefits them. Yes, this does happen quite a bit.
Not in politics.
Absolutely, every single day. And twice on Sundays. And so essentially what's going on here is they say that lawmakers and companies working together to craft legislation is by no means rare, but essentially, get this, the fact that Senator Roy Blunt, a Republican from Missouri, actually worked with Monsanto on a provision that in effect allows them to keep selling seeds which can then go on to be planted even if it is found to be harmful to consumers later on down the road, is stunning. It's just another example of corporations bending Congress to their will, and it's one that could have dire risks for health in America. We don't know yet, but if it happens, they're essentially granted immunity from any kind of repercussions.
Well, I mean, what's the difference between that and the FDA approving pills that are on the market that have all God knows what kind of side effects, and they don't test it, and later on down the road, people are having
what they always
adverse
argue,
reactions from, like, diet pills,
yeah,
you know?
Fin. Yeah, the first argument is that, well, but, you know, we had to act quickly to be able to try and address an immediate health concern.
No, you had to act quickly to make a buck.
That's Vioxx. More like, yeah, I think you're absolutely right, by the way, Caleb.
Well, I'm doing a little bit of research, and not having read the bill, I don't know if we can say for sure the totality of what's included in it.
You haven't read it? Funny, I don't think our congressman actually did either. Anyway,
well,
sorry, go ahead.
I wouldn't doubt that, but it seems that this portion that is effectively giving protections to the farmers mm-hmm. and the seeds they plant, which are supplied by Monsanto Corporation, it's kind of like a rider introduced into the bill that may not continue because riders have to be re-voted on, if I'm correct. But it's for a time period of 6 months from when it was signed into law, which would have been this week, yeah. giving us till about October, which effectively is the end of harvest time.
Right.
So it looks like before this clause may be taken out or stripped from any new legislation, we'll have a nice hardy crop to send all over the globe, because people sometimes forget that America provides a vast amount of foodstuffs and food production things for people all over the world.
And that's something that Chip Plesher brought up on his program again last night when I was on there. By the way, speaking of programs, Scotty Roberts was on Coast to Coast last night, if you guys didn't catch that.
He goes, Captain.
That just shows what it'll do for your career. You come on the Graylian Report, and then next week you're on Coast to Coast. But anyway, I digress.
How come I'm not on Coast to Coast?
Oh, yeah. Do you want to be on Coast to Coast? I'll call Tom Danhauser right now. We'll get
hey,
you on
I'm
there.
Sure they would love to talk to me. So, Caleb, what's up? Well, you know, fed the cat today.
I hope you didn't feed him anything with GMOs in it.
Of course not.
I digress. Three members of Congress, many of them were apparently unaware that the Monsanto Protection Act even existed within the bill. Guys, again, that's exactly what I'm saying. They tuck this stuff away inside a spending bill so that half the people who are voting on the spending bill don't know that there's something else in there potentially dangerous that they're voting for. In this hidden backroom deal, Senator Barbara Maluski turned her back on consumer, environmental, and farmer protection in favor of corporate welfare for biotech companies such as Monsanto, wrote Andrew Kimbrell, executive director of the Center for Food Safety. This abuse of power is not the kind of leadership that the public has come to expect from Senator Maluski or the Democrat majority in the Senate. Number four, the president did nothing to stop it either. Well, big surprise. Obama signed H.R. 933 while the rest of the nation was fixated on another hot issue, gay marriage. As a matter of fact, right here, I've got Time Magazine this week. It's got two gentlemen kissing. There was an alternative cover that had two women. They're not discriminating between the sexes. But the thing is that not to say that an issue like gay marriage isn't important, but I think that these kinds of issues are made important in conjunction with votes on things that are going to be maybe much, you know, more contentious on down the road. Think about, here's another example of this. Again, you can say that I'm a conspiracy theorist, but note every instance where I'm talking about this sort of thing happening, I'm giving you examples. So let's give you another example, okay? If, in this instance, the gay marriage issue didn't happen to be a breaking news item at the same time that this House Resolution 933 was voted on. Let's look at another similar issue.
Right before we do that, I don't mean to interrupt you. I don't know if you mentioned that H.R. 933 was the continuing resolution, which is effectively aiming to stall any sequestration happening in our government, effectively giving it 6 more months to pay its bills.
Oh, there you go.
So the Monsanto Protection Act was hidden within that spending bill, which I know you mentioned.
Right.
But this all plays along with what they're calling austerity in Europe, mm-hmm. which effectively is what they call the sequester here in the U.S.
Yeah, okay, good point. I'm glad you actually did bring that up. Okay.
Now
I may continue.
Are you bringing up the birth certificate?
I am.
Yeah,
I am. You've preempted me. Yes. Yeah, okay, real quick.
I can...
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, quick rundown. Basically, they asked for Obama's birth certificate the same day that Ben Bernanke from the Federal Reserve comes out and makes his first public statement, like, whatever.
The first time that the Federal Reserve had ever given a public press release.
Yeah, exactly.
Very interestingly, this issue, which really, to me, I do think it was something of a non-issue, but the birth certificate, or what they at least passed off as a birth certificate, yeah. was released that day. I think that's very interesting. And Where's
Donald Trump when you need him?
Well, I had friends in talk radio here that were jumping up all, and they were all over this birth certificate thing, and I said, guys, While you're looking at the left hand that's waving around, the right hand's gone behind the back. And guys, the Federal Reserve is giving a press release today. Is this not something that this is historic? Right here,
I did not even hear the birth certificate thing.
Yeah, yeah. The day that look at it. The day that the Barack Obama and the White House actually released what they acknowledged as being Barack Obama's birth certificate. Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve were giving their first ever public press release, their first
You're
press conference.
About a while back.
Yeah, this was a while back, yeah. Definitely. But this is another instance where, again, and I have to point this out.
Smoke and mirrors, man.
Yeah, that when this kind of thing happens, again, the International Business Times are the ones that actually talked about this. They said that while the rest of the nation was fixated on gay marriage, as the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments concerning California's Proposition 8, of course, Barack Obama was signing House Resolution 933. Coincidence? Maybe so. But I'm telling you, it happens time and time again just like that. While there's a big hot social issue going on behind the scenes, there's something very potentially dangerous that's being passed into law.
Also, while the Pentagon is photoshopping their map of a missile going to Austin, propagating that. I'm just kidding.
Oh, gosh.
Still.
Well, number five, before we get too long-winded here, it sets a terrible precedent. Though it will only remain in effect for 6 months, as Tyler noted, until the government finds another way to fund its operations. The message it sends is that corporations can get around consumer safety protections if they get Congress on their side. And furthermore, it sets a precedent that suggests that court challenges are a privilege and not a right. And it's really, really troubling to me. There are a lot of questions that are coming, well, I guess, into question here. And these things do need to be taken seriously. And so, for your information, your need to know, we talk about it here on the Graylian Report. Do you think that there's a government conspiracy? info@graylianreport.com. If you're listening live, hit us on the chat room. We'd like to hear what you think. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. When we come back, the portal to hell, only for real this time. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be right back. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
These mirrored illusions.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Gray Alien Report. If you want to join us by phone tonight, the phone lines are open, 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by contacting us at Skype ID Gray Alien Report. You can text message us anytime, 828-367-7201, or you can email us just as well. Those will come direct to me at info@grayalienreport.com. All that information is available at the podcast and radio page there at www.grayalienreport.com, so you have that information archived. Not archoned, so that you can listen to it at any time, find it, retrieve it, utilize it, make good use of it. Speak your voice, and we want to hear from you. You know, it's troubling, and I think that in the name of fairness, before we do move off the Monsanto discussion, I should point out that Snopes.com calls the conspiracy theory about the Farmer Protection, or is it the Farmer Protection Act?
It's Farmer Assurance Provision.
Right. The Farmer Assurance Provision, yes. It's going to be forever known as Monsanto Protection. But so Snopes says that it's about half and half, that there's a lot of truth to it, but there's also a lot of speculation about what this actually means. Now, Monsanto, on their website, actually released a statement. And here's what they had to say, their official statement. As a member of the biotechnology industry organization, we were pleased to join major power groups in supporting the Farmer Assurance Provision, including the American Farm Bureau Federation, the American Seed Trade Association, the American Soybean Association, the American Sugar Beet Growers Association, and the National Corn Growers Association.
High fructose corn syrup is sugar.
And of course, and we know that all the nutritional value in corn that you'll find out there these days, but I digress. Additional supporters included former secretaries of agriculture. A broad bipartisan group of legislators in both the House and Senate have supported the provision dating back to June 2012, and it passed with broad bipartisan support. As we understand it, the Monsanto company, the point of the Farmer Assurance Provision is to strike a careful balance, allowing farmers to continue to plant and cultivate their crops subject to appropriate environmental safeguards while USDA conducts any necessary further environmental reviews. A letter submitted by the industry in June 2012 provides additional information about what the provision is intended to accomplish, and that's what they have to say. So for what it's worth, Monsanto, well, you know, they're saying essentially nothing. I'm pretty skeptical. I remain skeptical. I don't know about all that. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And that said, for the meantime, we'll move along to something else. I do want to mention, by the way, Scotty Roberts went on to Coast AM last night and not only talked about his new book, The Secret History of the Reptilians, but of course he mentioned a little about Paradigm Symposium and Intrepid Mag. If you haven't been by the site yet, visit www.graylianreport.com. And if you're interested in what we do and you want to check out the official magazine of the Graylian Report, then here's another web URL for you just as well, intrepidmag.com. And if you go to either of those sites, you're going to look in the right-hand column, you're going to see a little button that talks about Intrepid Magazine. It says Intrepid Paradigm. We've got an Indiegogo campaign going right now, and you can donate and help us disseminate alternative news to a larger audience. Again, that is, of course, our friend Scotty Roberts, who appeared on the program last night, talking it up, fighting the good fight. You know how it goes. Did you guys see this yesterday where he's on the ISS right now, astronaut Chris Hadfield had tweeted some photos. Some very funny photos, and he had talked about seeing.
Is he the one with the mustache?
Yeah, and
he is all over the place. I saw him play a song with Bare Naked Ladies, and then he was like talking to Peter Gabriel, who is at NASA.
Well, you know, he was talking also about some orbital. I can't talk tonight. I'm having one of those nights. It must be this Peruvian coffee we're drinking here. The Hadals have spiked my brew again. Chris Hadfield is the astronaut here, and he was talking about orbital debris that was visible off in the distance.
Space junk?
Yes. He had said that there was some space junk visible off in the distance. And if you look at the photographs, it's an obvious flying saucer. Now, granted, today's April 2nd, so this was an April Fool's Day joke, but I thought it was pretty funny that one of the ISS astronauts is putting bogus images of a flying saucer out there. And he literally wrote, "Wow, what a huge piece of debris! Maybe I can grab it with the Canadarm 2," which is, of course, seen in one of the images. You can find those also at graylianreport.com. We linked to those just as well. But speaking of these, what was it, Tyler? I'm sorry. Was I interrupting you?
Oh, I was just going to say nothing new for NASA to fake photographs.
or furthermore, to doctor them, right?
Yeah, didn't the last time, well, in the past few years, they had to send someone out to put a toothbrush in that arm, did they not?
Yeah, right. But you know, the funny thing is that in most instances, they're actually airbrushing the saucers out. In this instance, they're airbrushing the saucer in, which reminds me.
How tricky.
Yes, on April Fool's Day. No, what it is, they didn't use an airbrush at all. They just left the flying saucer that was actually there in the photo and told everybody it was a joke.
It was obviously an old washing machine.
That's right. Yes, exactly. It was, you know, a part of a thruster that fell off a...
It's that Iranian spacecraft carrying that monkey they shot up a few weeks back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I hope the monkey's okay.
You know, with the black market drug sales, that's a real problem, the shooting up monkeys. Anyway, but now, I'll just tell you this.
I'm junked up.
Speaking of aliens, our good friend, we saw him, and we actually, it was so funny, because Caleb and I, the last day of the International UFO Congress in Arizona, we were sitting there with Rich Dolan and Mike Cleland and David Weatherly and Karen Dolan. We were all hanging out. And
Ray Stevens.
Ray Stevens was there. He really was. His book's laying right there. you know, the country singer, the funny guy. Anyway, and we were sitting there, and over beside us, Stephen Bassett came over, and he kind of sat down all by himself, and he had this great big bottle of wine. And I said, "Steve, you got a little bit of wine there with you?" Because he was sitting all by himself with this huge bottle of red wine. He says, "Oh yeah." He said, "I had to haggle with a woman down there in the casino to get her give me that." I like Steve, actually. I met him back last November up in Pennsylvania. And Steve, of course, is kind of overseeing a little event that's going to be taking place in Washington, I believe, later this month. Now, apparently, former Congresswoman Carolyn Kilpatrick and Congressman Merrill Cook, as well as Senator Mike Gravel. Remember Mike Gravel, right? They've agreed to sit
Mike
in...
Gravel.
Similar to Gravel, yes. Well, they have agreed to sit in a committee for citizen hearing at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on the 29th of this month through May the 3rd. Additional committee members will be announced later this month. An unprecedented event, according to the press release, with historical implications. The citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race will include 40 researchers and military agency witnesses who will testify for 30 hours over 5 days before former members of the United States Congress.
My God.
They will attempt to accomplish what the Congress has failed to do for 45 years, which is seek out facts surrounding the most important issue of this or of any time. The international spokesperson for the CHD is Apollo 14 astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell, fifth man, of course, to walk on the moon, who once very cryptically after a surgery told me that he had been briefed by people in upper echelons of government and that Earth had been visited and that the UFO phenomenon was a valid and real phenomenon.
If that ain't definitive proof, I don't know what it is.
Well, it isn't, actually, because, again, that's just his testimony. But the point is now this is where, again, a lot of people, you know, begin to take me to be, you know, a skeptic. Because I do question, you know, evidence versus proof. But anyway, the main ballroom of the NPC, National Press Club, will be configured to resemble a Senate hearing room, and there will be press sections, an audience area, and witness and committee tables. The hearing committee will include former members of Congress and two experts of counsel. To the extent possible, all appropriate protocols will be followed, as with congressional hearings. The entire hearing will be filmed as a basis for a forthcoming documentary called Truth Embargo to be produced by Just Cause Entertainment. Now, on November 4th, 2011, the White House had issued this statement. The U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race. In addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's eye. Again, though, I just don't know that that's necessarily a lie. I think that that may be based on available information. Again, we have to draw distinctions at times between what is UFO and what is ET. But nonetheless, and of course, Steve was one of the very guys who spearheaded the White House We the People petition, which that statement was in response to, which was asking for proof of extraterrestrial intervention. I don't know that we can so easily prove that ET is visiting planet Earth, but I don't think we can discount the UFO reality. We just have to be very careful about what we call a UFO. And that's why Bryce Zabel and my buddy Rich Dolan did a subsequent We the People petition where they didn't even use the word UFO. They referred entirely to unexplained aerial phenomenon. But once they got the ball rolling on that one, they weren't even able to get enough petition signatures. And the reason why is because, man, you got one good chance when something like this happens. And Stephen Bassett, he went after it, but I think I like Steve personally, but I don't think he used the right terminology. Nonetheless, for those interested in this, check out the Paradigm Research Group online at www.paradigmresearchgroup.org. The Citizen Hearing on Disclosure also has a website, www.citizenhearing.org, and then finally you can contact Stephen Bassett directly at 202-215-8344 or chd@citizenhearing.org. You know, I don't know that they're going to find proof of extraterrestrials, but I think it's interesting. And if at all possible, if we can work it out, the Grayling Report's actually going to go. I'd like to actually be there present for that hearing. It should be an interesting time. I hear our friend Jason McClellan at Open Minds may try and join us for that one just as well. So UFO journalists in the field, we're going to go and we're going to get exopolitical at the end of the month if we can work that one out. And all that to say, I find it interesting, and whether or not we find evidence of extraterrestrials, the question and the debate as it relates to UFOs is definitely a matter near and dear to my heart. I think it'll be interesting to be there.
Yep. I'm looking forward to driving.
Caleb's going to be our official driver, Tyler. You hear that?
I can't wait to drive through Washington. That's going to be fun.
Oh, yes, indeed.
D.C., that's a little scary.
We're going to be going right into the heart of Mordor. Yes, the all-seeing eye at the top of the pyramid is going to be staring and shooting its blazing hell fury down upon us. And speaking of, did you guys hear? With it being April 1st, I was trying to confirm if this was actually, I assumed it was actually a hell of a good story, and you'll see why here in just a moment. The Mail Online reported, is this the gate of hell? Hail?
Hey, is that the gate of hail?
You know, by the way, Caleb, when I went on J&K After Dark yesterday, one of the questions they asked was, Micah, why do you and Caleb, why do your voices sound differently? In other words, I, in the mouth of the South, I have a Southern accent, and yet you're my biological brother, and you don't have much of a Southern accent. What happened there?
Because I'm straight from hail.
No, it's because I grew up, I learned how to speak from the TV. You learned how to speak from our parents.
But our parents don't, well, my mom kind of does.
Mom totally does.
Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, it's funny because one gentleman came up to me at Paradigm Symposium and said, you know, it's surreal standing here, finally talking to the real mouth of the South, but it's so funny because you're young and you're well dressed and your hair, you know, it's nice. And when we listen to the program, man, I always imagine like a 40-year-old truck driver with a great big beard and a cowboy hat sitting there. It's like Don Imus or something.
I just further like figured out the analogy tonight that you're the GW, you're the George Herbert Walker, and I'm the Jeb Bush of the family.
Yes. Yeah, that's really what it's all about right there. You know, actually, let's catch this one after the break. We're going to go on out to break real quick, but I'm going to tease real quick with this. I'll tell you this. I thought it was something of a April Fool's story, but apparently this is real. I like to be careful when I say this is real on a program like the Grayling Report, though. This is where the real becomes unreal, conspiracy theory becomes conspiracy fact, and of course the unusual is usual. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this. Stay tuned.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. The dark disquiet, that little corner of the web from which we broadcast each week to you at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Or worldwide, around the web, on the internet, downloaded via podcasting clients such as iTunes and the like. Yes, you know all about us now. Ha ha ha. Welcome back to the program. So the gate to hell. I was trying to determine if this program or if this story was accurate or not. Initially, I'd seen the story at Fox News. And I go digging around, assuming, again, this was an April 1st story. So I thought, okay, this is all bogus, right? And sure enough, I go looking. And many of the mainstream news sources were carrying this, which begs the question. I started wondering, the wording of the story... Okay, the title of the story, Is This the Gate of Hell? I'd wondered if one news source, because this happened a few weeks back. Remember, we had been a little skeptical about the story about the armed dolphins. Yeah, it ended up being bunk. It was an elaboration of a story, and it wasn't even, I don't think even at the beginning of it, it was a truism. It was silliness that ended up being proliferated, and then the Atlantic carried the story. And it's funny because when the Atlantic carried the story, they commented on the fact that they apologized for misreporting or misrepresenting, a bogus story. But then they also said, however, it is true that the Ukrainians and the United States have trained dolphins for tactical use during wartime. So there's a grain of truth to it, even though we messed up. And so the story, is this the gate of hell? Archaeologists say temple doorway belching noxious gas matches ancient accounts of... I didn't make that up. That's exactly as written at the Mail Online. It matches ancient accounts of a portal to the underworld. Now, I first saw it at Fox News, and then I found it at the Daily Mail, and I thought, surely this was like an Associated Press story that was complete BS. They're talking about it as though it is actually true. And what it actually had to do with was a temple site where, indeed, there were noxious gases produced by the earth that were released from a cave, a sort of a natural vent in the lay of the land, around which a doorway had been built. And Strabo and other ancient historians had written about this and had referred to it as the actual gateway to hell.
And that's where they dropped the ring in.
That's where they dropped the ring in, yeah.
In the fires of Mount Doom.
Now, archaeologists say that they have discovered these so-called gates of hell, which were at one time believed to be a mythical portal to the underworld in Greek and Roman legend, at a site near the ancient city of Hierapolis. Now what's called, I'm going to give this my best shot.
Kerry King's residence.
Yes, Kerry King's residence. Yes.
I thought you said Larry King's residence.
Probably Larry King's.
He lives next door.
Now, it's actually Pamukkale, okay, a location in southwestern Turkey, which is said to closely match historical descriptions of what was known as the Plutonian in Greek and a similar word in Latin. Maybe in the Plutonian in Greek and then the Plutonium in Latin. Pluto, I guess, being one rendition of the famous god of the underworld, correct? So, well, anyhow, in its heyday, a small temple with traditional Greco-Roman pillars was said to have stood next to this literal belching hole in the ground. There's a great big large hole in the ground that's just belching noxious fumes.
Whoa!
I think they've found the rear end of planet Earth.
And finally, I was wondering for so long.
It's the bog of eternal stench.
This is the real life bog of eternal stench, Tyler. And describing the site, the Greek geographer Strabo, in around 24 AD, said this space is full of a vapor so misty and dense that one can scarcely see the ground, and that any animal that passes inside will meet instant death. Now, very kindly, apparently he wasn't an animal activist in his day, Strabo says, I threw in some sparrows and they immediately breathed their last and fell. It's very interesting. And so they're saying that this is actually believed to be the real site. They announced, archaeologist Francesco D'Andrea announced the discovery at a conference on Italian archaeology in Istanbul. And he said that his team had managed to pinpoint the location by reconstructing the route of the thermal springs. Among the ruins, the archaeologists found a cave with Ionic semi-columns upon which were inscriptions with dedications to the gods of the underworld, Pluto and Kore. Dr. D'Andrea told Discovery News, we could see the cave's lethal properties during the excavation. Several birds died as they tried to get close to the warm opening. They were instantly killed by the carbon dioxide plumes. The archaeologist who famously claimed to have found the tomb of St. Philip, one of the 12 apostles of Jesus Christ, or he is the very same, back in 2011. The ancient city was founded around 190 BC, back before there were four digits. Okay.
Wow.
So there is a hollow earth.
Well, this is apparently an entrance to, something.
Is that where that goat baby thing came from, too?
The goat baby thing. Are you talking about...
I'm talking about that well they dug up and they brought that... They birthed that goat baby devil.
You can tell we all grew up listening to Art Bell. Yeah, that was the story of Mel's Hole, Caleb. A different hole in the ground. It was Mel's Hole. Yeah.
And the Bell's Hole is Art Bell's story, right?
The story about Mel's Hole is that they had lowered, I think, like a lamb or something or a goat down into the hole to see what the strange properties of the hole would actually...
Jurassic Park style.
Because the legend had been that, according to Mel, and Mel's identity was never confirmed, and so a lot of people think that it was all just kind of a big spoof that Art Bell pulled, but the story goes that Mel would at times... Mel himself, but there were legends that he had found about natives in the area that would, they'd take a dead animal or something and throw it in there, and that the dog would appear days later and it'd be returned to life. Kind of like a real life pet cemetery. Okay,
sorry, I didn't mean to get you off track. I just wanted to.
Oh no! I mean, seriously, it's interesting. But Mel's Hole, the story. I mean, I've always wondered about that too. Essentially a cave that just seems to go on forever and ever and ever, and has weird mystical properties. That's exactly what the Greeks apparently thought here. Or the ancient Turkeys, I guess, as it was. Ancient Turkeys believed they had a hole to hell. That's what the headline should have read. It might as well have. And on, of course, April Fool's Day. How perfect. Could it be any more perfect? Anyway, and speaking of hell, I found another one. This is pretty interesting. Things have been getting pretty out of hand in Greece right now. Everybody knows about this. But get this. Emboldened recently by its meteoric rise in Greece, as they call it, the far-right group known as the Golden Dawn Party is spreading its tentacles abroad. I love this. The Guardian actually...
Cthulhu!
They actually said that. They said, spreading its tentacles abroad amid fears, it is acting on its pledge to create cells in every corner of the world. Now, the extremist group, which forged links with British neo-Nazis when it was founded in the 1980s, has begun opening offices in Germany, Australia, Canada, and the U.S. But, to be a neo-Nazi group, that's a very interesting name for them to have just as well. The Golden Dawn. Think about the ties. The Order of the Golden Dawn, and the Ordo Templi Orientis, Aleister Crowley and the Thelema. Serious tie-ins with esoterica and black magic and sorcery and things like that. It just goes to show that, I guess, even in the modern era, it's well known in the past that Nazis, especially during the Third Reich, Hitler and the Nazis were fascinated with esoterics and with, esoteric knowledge and spiritualism and the occult and things like that. It seems that the same holds true even today. I find that very, very interesting.
Well, the actual party in Greece is the largest ruling party, and they are known as New Democracy, and they are trying to appeal to the fascist Golden Dawn vote. And I think some of the proposals trying to make a relationship with or include proposing to ban immigrants from the police and military and attacking naturalization laws affecting hundreds of thousands of immigrant children.
It's, I tell you, I have a look at this or a feeling about this, and it actually takes me back to Easter Sunday. I was talking with my uncle, okay? My uncle was an investor, and he does different things with the stock market and things like that. And so he and I have a mutual interest in economics. And so we stepped outside, and we were talking about economics. And I mentioned to him, we brought up Greece. And he was telling me, literally it's going to hell in a handbag over there, because essentially for this bailout, what they're having to do is they're essentially confiscating people's actual earnings or rather, I guess, their actual property. And this is being put up as collateral, in not so many words. And the seizure of property for purposes of being able to try and maintain or regain some iota of economic stability in a global market that has been absolutely tumultuous for the last several years. I mean, it's very scary that you could actually see, a government doing this. And I think right now people are probably not only afraid, they're angry. And when you have people who are scared, angry, and they're potentially going to be very hungry, it's not a good equation. That populace is going to be very, they're going to be looking for an answer. And this is the kind of thing that history has shown will lead to problems. So, you know, this is something we'll want to keep our eye on. I found it interesting, of course, because of that connection with, of course, Esoterica. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, this stuff seems to breed in times of economic hardship.
I mean, sure.
68 years after, you know, the Nazi rule of Europe. And the same thing.
Well, parts of Europe.
The thing, same thing, well, right, but very small part.
Right.
The same thing that we talked about earlier, the austerity in Europe and the sequester here in America, we are seeing things in the U.S. like the new militia movement, the right-wing threat, which is very much tied to... This is really... It's hard to find like a left-leaning source that doesn't have a story about armed militias or the new lone wolf terrorist. This goes right along with this movement in Greece.
Well, I think the important point to make is, see, a lot of people would hear what you're saying, and they would say, you're trying to tie American patriots in, okay, with a bunch of Nazis, a bunch of neo-Nazis halfway across the world. I know what
in a way I am.
Oh, well.
I'm doing it so to bring up the distinctions in that argument. I mean, the news we get should be filtered through our lens and understanding and not used as one point of reference. It should be used as one point of reference in regards to the bigger source.
Mm-hmm.
So we hear about that, the Patriot movement being a bunch of racist, gun-toting, you know.
Right, but I mean, that's not a fair assessment to make of every individual. Okay, I'll tell you this. I think that obviously there's a lot of concern and a lot of paranoia in America. Like we've talked about previously, people are afraid about having the guns taken away. I think often what's going on is that when there's fear and when there's tension, you start seeing it literally breeding like bacteria.
Exactly.
Socially. And so, and I think this is what I was trying to say, is that the point you were trying to make, I think it's, I am a patriotic American. I support people's right to bear arms. I am not a big fan of a lot of regulation, and I'm not a big fan of a bunch of big government trying to, on a broad reaching scale, tell, you know, a huge populace what they need to do. I think, again, it's so funny because a lot of people who are my friends who are, you know, far left, again, I'm a centrist, but a lot of my friends who are far left say, well, I disagree with you. We need more big government. And then they'll go around and they'll say, you know, think globally, act locally. Oh, we need small stuff. We need little businesses. We need our local stuff. And I'm like, see, we don't really disagree, because what you're talking about in essence is very similar to what I'm trying to say here too. I think that we need to be more active, and we need to be able to be more self-reliant on a local level, in a locality where we actually have some degree of control over what's going on, not somebody voting something that's going to have broad-reaching and potentially very destructive long-term results in Washington, D.C. in the middle of the night, okay, that affects everybody, okay, countrywide. There is a big problem with that. But when coming back to what you're talking about here, Tyler, again, while it's fine, and I even advocate people being patriotic, people's right to bear arms, and people's individual liberties, the important point to make here is that while you see that, there are always, no matter where you go in the world, going to be people who will take things to an extreme. And it emerges, it has a different face or a different name or a different color. It can be right, it can be left, or it can be right down the middle completely, you know, void of anything, political, governmental, economic, or anything. But when people are basically put under extreme stress, fear, and duress, when they get hungry enough, they eat each other, okay? And
that is my point, exactly.
I think you said
it better than I could, but...
Dude, how do you think Alex Jones sells his survival seeds? He scares the crap. He scares the crap out of everybody, and then he's like, buy my kit. It's got a gas mask, seeds, and toilet paper, and MREs ready to go.
You're kind of right, actually, in the sense that... they say peace sells, but who's buying? You remember the old Megadeth album? Well, fear sells even better than peace.
Of course it does.
Really quickly, in Greece, you look at Greece, look at Cyprus, you have two countries that are part of a larger European Union that are being burdened with debt held by the European Union, but it's taken out on the actual citizens. You've got massive unemployment, and you have wage drops that are huge. These people are under immense stress, and in those times, like we're talking about, this stuff seems to rear its head and gather force. The same thing can be said to be happening in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is the U.S. is a large piece of land inhabited by a lot of different types of cultures and people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And again, it doesn't matter where you go. When people, again, are put under, the absolute stress, fear, not knowing how they're going to make ends meet, not going to know where the jobs or where the houses or where anything else is going to be, 2 days from now, 2 weeks, 2 years, these are trying times for people everywhere around the world and here in America just as well. You know, we have the threat from, literal threats being, launched by North Korea right down there. That a lot of people are just, they've got a long history of saying stuff like that. But what happens when those idiots decide to actually launch a nuclear warhead? What happens?
They never will.
One thing that I have to say about, the information that we are getting, I keep watching, I try not to, but I can't help but kind of be brought into it, but seeing the mainstream news and they're saying sources say North Korea said this, North Korea is saying this. Well, okay, well, who are these sources exactly? Like, where exactly is this information coming from? And nobody seems to question this, at least in mainstream media itself, but the independent media is questioning the crap out of it. And that's why I really enjoy the independent news sources and stuff like that, because at least they're questioning, like, hey, where is this stuff coming from?
This is exactly the reason why we are always talking about it. Look, don't take my word for it. I think that peer review when it comes to science, and I think that, frankly, citing your sources when it comes to news and media, these things are important. But at times, alternative media is important because you're going to hear the conversation there that you're not going to hear everywhere else. And the hard questions, sometimes the ones that the mainstream are not going to touch, are going to be asked in that context and in that area. Here we are. It's that area known as the Mohorovic discontinuity. We're asking the tough questions. It is the Grayling Report, and I'm Micah Hanks along with Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman. We've been talking about all the hot conspiracies of the day this hour. Next hour, we're going to scare the living daylights out of you. Stay tuned.
The Outback. Andrew Nicholson's latest, Weird Australia. Real reports, uncanny creatures, strange sightings, extraordinary encounters. Weird Australia, the latest from researcher Andrew Nicholson. For more information, visit WeirdAustralia.com.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report. Thank you so much for joining us once again, my friends. In this hour, we're going to be terrifying you, I hope. I always like to scare my listeners, and so we're going to have some creepy audio. While you're there at the website, www.grailienreport.com, I implore you to take a look at our Indiegogo campaign for Intrepid and Paradigm. That'll help us spread more alternative news to the world, just like our friends around the globe do. Who Farted Magazine, Open Minds, of course. Fine stuff they're doing out there. There are so many people who do a good job at this, and I think we all have to unite together. The internet radio networks, the online blogs, the websites, the magazines, the television programs, all of these things that are a bit off the cuff. Come together, ask the tough questions, and let's recompose a reconstituted reality from the best stuff available out there, whether it be in real life, on the web, or anywhere else. It's important stuff, and we're trying to do it for you here. I'm Micah Hanks, and of course it is the Grayling Report, so thank you so much for being a part of it, as always. Now, that said, before we get into scaring the living daylights out of people, I do want to bring up one more story that was a hot one. It's a real well, actually, I guess it's not so hot, actually. And this is interesting, again, because it is questioning the status quo, if you will. The Australian was the website that carried this. This is a big story this week. 20-year hiatus in rising temperatures has climate scientists puzzled. This is very interesting. Debate about the reality of a two-decade pause in global warming and what it means has made its way from the skeptical fringe to the mainstream. You know, in a lengthy article this week, The Economist magazine said if climate scientists were if they were credit rating agencies, then climate sensitivity, the way climate reacts to changes in carbon dioxide levels, would be on negative watch but not yet downgraded. Another paper published by leading climate scientist James Hansen, the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, says the lower-than-expected temperature rise between 2000 and the present could be explained by increased emissions from burning coal. For Hansen, the pause is a fact, but it's good news that probably won't last. International Panel on Climate Change Chairman Rajendra Puchari recently told The Weekend Australian the hiatus would have to last 30 to 40 years at least to break the long-term warming trend. But again, what this all seems to point to is that it's a bit curious, but there has been essentially a hiatus for the last two decades in rising temperatures. I am not someone who is, I'm not a hardline skeptical debunker. You know, I'm not an open-minded, I am open-minded, but I'm not a believer. You tell me whatever I'm not supposed to believe and I'm going to see it's true because I just want to stand athwart conventional science. I'm not that kind of person either. You know, I'm a person who says, let's allow the facts to land where they do and then let's base our opinions on what those facts actually tell us, what the proof is, okay? I'm that guy who's not just looking for pie, I want proof in my pudding. And we have to take into consideration a lot of things that are troubling here. I had a friend in NASA actually a few years ago when I talked about this on this very program say, I need to set you straight on global warming, Micah. And I said, well, I don't know that I'm...
Well, Mr. Gore.
Yes, I don't know that I'm that off base is the thing. Sure, there are elements that are visible and that are measurable scientifically that seem to indicate that there are temperature changes that occur over long periods, okay, that are measurable by, you know, scientific implements and tools and the like. And one theory presently, based on the data that is accumulated over the last few decades, is that global temperatures are on the rise. Although, there is apparently what is being described as a 20-year hiatus in rising temperatures, which has puzzled proponents of global warming. It says in the headline there, climate scientists are puzzled, but really what they're saying is global warming proponents can't explain this anomaly in the data. That's what we talk about on this program, is anomalies. Now, I'll just say this, too. Remember what happened just a few years ago at East Anglia University in the UK. Okay, Phil Jones and a lot of those climate scientists really caught some heat because there was not only discussion of deleting emails that had to do with their questions of similar trends. They were concerned about why they couldn't prove that there were warming trends. And they literally talked with one another about if we just delete these emails, then if a Freedom of Information Act request comes through, we won't be liable. We won't have to provide information if it doesn't exist. So delete your emails and correspondences so they won't be, you know, we won't be proven wrong.
Of course.
Furthermore, this, you know, I'm telling you, people don't think that there's stuff that goes on behind the scenes. You conspiracy theorists. You know, whether it has to do with a House resolution or a spending bill that has information about, you know, again, basically granting political immunity to people who may be poisoning us, okay, with genetically modified seeds and foodstuffs. Whether it has to do with that or whether it has to do with climate science. Look, let me tell you a little bit about what also was going on in East Anglia. They were taking dendrochronological data, tree ring data. When, you know, warm periods occur, tree growth is apparently a little bit more quick, and they can actually measure the distance from ring to ring, which is representative of a period of annual growth typically with a tree, and they can actually measure whether the tree grew more quickly and therefore if temperatures in accordance with that were higher. When the data didn't seem to match the global warming trends that the researchers were looking for, they spiked the data sets, and this was actually found in the source code that was released. It was a big scandal. They called it ClimateGate a few years ago. Old news. Everybody knows about that. But what actually was found was that they were taking tree ring data, and when the data didn't do what they wanted it to do, they manipulated it so that it would. And this is the kind of thing that goes on. They say, well, it is science because we were actually effectively predicting what those trends were when the data was missing. But I'm sorry, science isn't let's guess and then make sure that it fits the mold of what we were expecting to find anyway. It's no, let's look for data and let's let the data point to the truth. Well, okay, and when you don't have data, you can't make a presumption. I'm sorry, Tyler, I know you're dying to get in here. Hold on, two more seconds. If you don't have data to back up the presumption itself alone is not a truth. And I think that that's been a lot of what's been going on with climate science over the last few decades. And what we're having to, what the facts are telling us now, we have to look at the fact that whether or not you believe in or you disbelieve or if you agree with or disagree with or, you know, take politics out of it. What the facts are saying is that there has been a 20-year hiatus and that climate scientists are now having to question what exactly that means. Okay, Tyler, sorry, I'm done.
I just want to give my opinion, and I'm definitely not saying anything to tarnish the institution of science, but what we have today is science with the bill footed by political and corporate donors.
Well,
every piece of research that's going to be propagated across to all of us slaves is going to be paid for by one arm or the other, and all the research is done in order to reach the bottom line. It's almost as if the prediction, the results have to meet the prediction, or else it's not published.
There's an expectation.
In certain experiments, I'll put that, because there's a lot of, you know, very good science being done.
Yeah, I think that that's something that's very important, you know, that there is an expectation. There is an expectation, and certain standards have to be met. And see, this is the whole thing. Who is it that was talking to me about this? I think it was actually in relation to the Intrepid Magazine Indiegogo campaign. Somebody was actually saying to me, literally, that what we're having to do here is we're having to look at information so long as people who are funding the information are getting what they want. And as long as you've got people who are actually providing funding for anything, you know, there's an inherent problem, because the information and the control of the information is going to at all times somewhat be dictated, whether in large part or in small part, by the interests of those who are willing to put forward the money to help with that. That's just the way that the cookie crumbles.
Yeah, science is expensive. You have to have donors or patrons to afford to even do a simple experiment.
Coming back to the whole idea that everything's laid out plain and simple, and obviously there's no conspiracy going on. Tyler, what were you talking about right before the show started? Who just found dog meat in their products? Do you remember?
Lord, it was.
Do you remember what that was?
It was some scandal in the UK, I believe, where they found dog meat in curry.
Yeah. Obviously, everything's out on the table. First, you have the horse meat scandal, then we have dog meat. That's fun.
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently, the world is going to hell in a handbag.
It reminds me of the Simpsons episode when they go in and they see the rats being milked, and the mayor walks in and says, "You promised us dog or higher."
Oh my gosh! Well, there are times I think where it just gets a little nasty. Okay, one more before we get to electronic voice phenomenon. This is the hot topic of the night, and I do want to talk about this. There was so much conspiracy news this week, I had to focus on some of it. You know, that's part of what we do here on the program. But now, I guess actually this might still fit a little bit into the conspiracy theory idea, but it's a good segue, because not only is there a conspiracy theory here, there's a good bit of woo, and then this also has to do with cell phones, okay, or telephone calls, because here in just a moment we're going to be talking about phone calls from the dead. Okay. Now, this story has been carried by many news sources. The Mail Online had actually featured photographs taken from a film in 1938 that shows a woman walking along. Now, this is 1938. Now, do you remember there was a film that was released a few years ago, and there was, I think it was outside the premiere of a Charlie Chaplin film, and there was a woman that goes along walking by, and she looks like she's holding an object up next to her head, and people are saying,
"Oh, the cell phone."
Yeah, and people are saying,
yeah.
"John Titor."
Everyone
time
said
travelers in a Charlie Chaplin movie.
So the idea is that there are a lot of people out here who are utilizing cell phones and things, okay, in these, you know, pieces of film that date back to the 1930s. And so the allegation made by the conspiracy theorist, I guess this is still a conspiracy, is that there are actual evidences in these films of time travelers. Now, I think in that instance, with the release, some people are very serious about it, Caleb. But
and they were really serious about Voldemort being one of the Secret Service members the other week, too.
I guess so. But the thing is that...
Time to die.
In the instance with the Charlie Chaplin film, there was a woman... you know, who was walking along, and she had claimed... what I thought was going on there is that she was actually holding an ear trumpet up to her ear. I thought it was... You know what an ear trumpet is?
She was playing an ear trumpet. It plays out. Yes, I know what an ear trumpet is. It helps you hear.
An ear trumpet, was kind of a primitive hearing aid device, okay? And so this woman was walking along. Now, what's kind of peculiar about it is, while it looks like she's holding an ear trumpet up to her head, presumably to help her hear, she's talking at the same time, which certainly gives the impression that she's actually talking on a phone. But then there's this instance where... And this is pretty bizarre. Again, the film in question, shows a young woman, apparently a factory woman or a factory worker. Okay, it's black and white footage, and this young female, along with several other women, comes walking along, and she's apparently talking into a wireless handset, said to have been filmed at a factory in the United States in the 1930s. It was 1938, to be precise. Different film from the Charlie Chaplin film, okay? Different film.
Yeah.
And you can clearly see, I'm looking at the photographs right now, the video, which has attracted more than 300,000 views on YouTube, clearly shows a woman walking along, and she's holding, it's pretty large, but it's what looks like either a walkie-talkie or a cell phone, and she's walking along, talking into this thing,
it's
smiling.
It's a Cracker Jack box, and she's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A radio.
Well, it's really interesting because, I mean, in this video, it seems far less likely that this woman is holding a primitive hearing aid device. I mean, it looks like she's really talking into this thing, and it's actually a phone. Well, check this out. The official explanation that has now been given is that a YouTube user came forward and claimed that they actually not only had the answer, but that they recognized the woman in the film. They said that the woman was actually the person's grandmother. Okay, the YouTube user, or their great-grandmother, rather. And that the woman really was using a cell phone in 1938. So, okay, is she a time traveler? What's going on here?
She had a can on a string.
It's a hogophone. Yeah, you know, we have up here in the mountains what in folklore we call a hogophone, where there is a piece of hog skin stretched over a window, and then a hog skin stretched over your neighbor's window, and you run a piece of wire between the two, and that way you can talk back and forth. David Holt, a Grammy Award-winning folk musician that Caleb and I have known. Of course, I've performed with him a few times over the years. David used to tell the story of the hogophone. I thought that was hilarious. No, it wasn't a hogophone. This woman actually, according to the YouTube user, the woman is apparently talking into a device outside of a factory that was owned by the U.S. industrial giant DuPont. And the story goes that the woman was named Gertrude Jones. The YouTube user who commented on this video, if this is to be believed, says, "The lady you see is my great-grandmother, Gertrude. She was 17 years old at the time, and I asked her about this video. She's still alive, and she remembers it quite clearly. She says DuPont had a telephone communications section in the factory. Now, they were experimenting with wireless telephones at the time. Gertrude and five other women were given wireless phones to test for a week. Gertrude, in the film, as you can see, is talking to one of the scientists holding another wireless phone who is off to her right as she walks by. So far, there's been no independent verification of this allegation made by the YouTube user. So I'd be interested in seeing if indeed, whether or not, in 1938, DuPont was truly involved in, experimental wireless communication.
Well, they had electric cars.
Well, there you go.
It's interesting because most of those films, I can't remember the very details of film history, but I believe most all motion pictures were under one studio, RKO.
Until there was a
court case on it where it was ruled a monopoly, and that's where you had had their own theaters and everything else.
Well, who knows?
Same actors.
I'll put it out to people. If anyone has any information about this, I'd be very interested in finding out if they know anything about this. We'll have the story linked in our show notes tonight. It's very, very curious indeed. Was the woman actually talking on a cell phone? And more importantly, my question is, was there actually a plausible explanation for why in 1938 she was walking on a cell phone, as this person has asserted? Because if
walking on a cell phone.
Doing what?
You said walking on a cell phone.
Walking and talking. Talking and walking, Anyway, I'm Micah Hanks. When we come back, phone calls from the dead. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. We were just discussing whether or not an actual time traveler was visible in a 1938 piece of footage talking on a cell phone.
From the future, Marty.
So were people actually traveling back to 1938 so that they could make phone calls with a cell phone, since there were no cell phone towers back then, of course? Obviously, the cell phone towers didn't have to be there for the cell phone to work because the technology and the time period at which the cell phone was created... anyway, never mind. You see where I'm going with that.
No, time is actually moving backwards, and we are devolving.
No, yes, that's only when Stephen Hawking figures out that... what was it, Mike?
Yes.
That we'll all be walking backwards?
Yes. Yeah, Stephen said he didn't actually endorse that. He said that at one time he had thought that because of the thermodynamic arrow of time, something I talk about in the book The UFO Singularity, he had said that he assumed that in relation to the outward expansion and the growth, you know, emanating from the Big Bang, you know, entropy and all things that humans perceive are in accordance with the direction thermodynamically in which entropy increases. And therefore, he says that as I guess we're in expansion right now, and as soon as the universe begins to contract back within itself, we'd all be walking around backwards, and you know, which wouldn't occur in our lifetime. But you know, I guess the play, you know, the I guess what you'd call the passage of time, since time immemorial, since the beginning point of the universe as we know it, would begin to play backwards, and so everything will happen again in reverse order. And then he began to doubt that. I think that's a fairly
boring. God, that would be like rewatching the Star Wars prequels.
Just shaking a Cracker Jack box and yelling why she couldn't find the prize.
Exactly. Well,
what it is it's rewinding at normal speed. That's no fun, right?
Okay, let's stop talking about this. It's bumming me out.
Let's rewind for a moment, and I want to take you back to the late 1960s. As a matter of fact, let's take this all the way back to famous... Thank you, Tyler, for providing us some music there. You should be flowers, you know. Taking us all the way back to the days of psychologist Carl Jung. Carl Jung, of course, the man who coined the term synchronicity. I don't know that we could say that Carl Jung was necessarily a proponent of electronic voice phenomenon. In fact, if what we know today as being EVP actually existed, it would be interesting to hear what Jung's interpretation of that might be, but I don't think that the popular use of that term or the study of alleged spirit voices caught on tape was ever anything that Jung himself spoke about or knew of. I don't think it was even something that was a cultural meme while he was alive. But the point is that one of Jung's predecessors, I guess, you know, a young man who actually spent years in study under Carl Jung. He was one of his students. He was a Latvian-born writer and intellectual. His name was Konstantin Raudive. This guy, in his day, was probably one of the best-known electronic voice phenomenon researchers. And so our study tonight of the parapsychology, if you will, of electronic voice phenomena will focus for a while on this man, Konstantin Raudive. He was a student of psychologist Carl Jung, and he spent probably the last 10 years of his life seriously studying EVP. He believed that spirits of the dead could reach from beyond the grave and come back to talk to humans. Some would allege that they could even utilize a telephone to do so. Now, Raudive had spent a number of years in exile, just after the Soviet reconquest of Latvia during the Second World War. And while psychology had been his primary career, he did have a peculiar passion for parapsychology throughout his life. And so later in his life, of course, he took very seriously the idea that machines could be used to record voices of the dead. Now, together with a German parapsychologist named Hans Bender, Raudive researched the mysteries of electronic voice phenomenon. And he eventually even published a book on the subject in 1971, just a few years before he died, which was called Breakthrough, as it was released in the United States. Elsewhere, it had a different title. Now, Raudive, it began for him in 1964. He'd read a book by a researcher named Fredrik Jurgensen called Voices from Space, which reminds me actually of an article that was written by Preston Dennett in Fate magazine, I think, in 2008, maybe. It was called Phone Call from an Alien.
Or perhaps what Nikola Tesla experienced when he thought he was getting a voice call from Mars.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there've been a lot of, you know, somebody.
Sorry,
should...
I just totally channeled Tyler right there.
You abducted the conversation, is what you did. There's actually a long history of mechanical communication with not just ghosts, but people who, you know, Nikola Tesla did it, Thomas Edison, you know, the fascist. Or I guess actually he was really a Nazi supporter here in the in North Carolina and other parts of the Americas during the Second World War. William Dudley Pelley, he used to live right here in Asheville, and he also claimed to have had a machine that could be used to
communicate with the dead. So there have been many who have claimed over the years to have been able to do this. But Konstantin Radive had been a little more serious about it. After reading the book by Jurgensen, Voices from Space, he literally sought Jurgensen out, and he decided that he wanted to get to know this guy. They ended up becoming friends and working together, and they started working to try and reproduce alleged recordings of, again, what became popularly known as electronic voice phenomenon. Now, this at first only resulted in, really weak little muffled things, and honestly, I think it was pretty questionable at first whether there were actually voices being recorded. But one evening, while Radive sat alone listening to one of the recordings, he claimed he could clearly hear a number of different voices appearing through the static and the white noise. So he played the tape over and over again alone, listening carefully. And before long, with each new repetition, he began to feel that he was better able to discern what was actually being said. He could hear more clearly each time. And each time, the messages became not only more clear, but even more personal to him. He claimed that some were in the German language, others were in French, and others were in his native Latvian. And then, get this, there was a final voice on that particular tape. According to Radive, he said it was a woman's voice, and as he listened to it, he could hear it saying, "Va dormir, Margarete. Va dormir, Margarete," which, translated to English, had meant, "Go to sleep, Margaret. You're drunk again." No, I'm kidding. But it meant, "Go to sleep, Margaret."
Damn you, Radio Free Europe.
Now listen, hear this.
It's a bunch of interference like we'd get in our amps. You pick up the local fundamentalist.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
We had some interference earlier before we went down to the bunker with our cars.
We did, actually. Yeah, that was a strange 14 occurrence in itself.
Now you know the rest of the story.
And that's the way the cookie crumbles.
But anyway, there's a Hadel in the... Did you hear that Hadel? He was on his microphone over there. Yes, our pet Hadel. Okay. So the words, "Go to sleep, Margaret." These words, according to Radive, had made a very deep impression on him. And the reason why is because he said Margarete Petarutsky, a friend of his, had died very recently, and her illness and death had greatly affected him. And in this clip of audio, he said that he could clearly discern. It was the last thing that he could hear in a succession of different voices that he'd had to listen a little more carefully to be able to discern all of them. But this one had said, clearly enough to his satisfaction, to be concise about it, he said it had said, "Go to sleep, Margaret." And he thought this was clearly an indication from the other side that had to do with his friend, Margaret, who had recently passed away. Well, fascinated by what he had perceived as a possible way to maybe vindicate the claims of life after death, Radive began a nonstop pursuit of ways that he hoped he could actually improve communication. He believed it already existed, essentially, and he wanted to try and improve on the ways that technological, mechanical methods could be applied to apparently trying to talk with ghosts from beyond. And he really believed that these things were actually communicating directly with him. Now get this, with the help of a bunch of EVP experts. Okay. Radive died in 1974, but literally he'd begun in 1964, and he only had about 10 years to work there. He didn't know he was going to die, I guess, but the thing is that he nonetheless managed to get a lot of work done in that time. Now, a lot of people have taken away from the argument on EVP, and sure, I think it is still questionable, but there are some instances. I've heard some pretty remarkable EVP recordings in my day. And Radive had actually worked with, get this, I think he'd recorded something around the 100,000 different audio tapes, and he had also worked with 400 different individuals, colleagues like Jurgensen and, of course, Hans Bender, another fellow, a German parapsychologist he'd worked along with. There were 400 people who had claimed during experiments with Radive that they had also heard these voices on these tapes. And he had 100,000 of the audio tapes that he'd recorded, by which he thought that there was some sort of a mechanical process through which disembodied voices could not only be heard speaking, but also would often say things that were, if not recognizable or relevant, sometimes made by voices that he felt were recognizable just as well. And so the testimony from these associates and witnesses, 400+, were essentially compiled and edited and put together into this book called What Is Inaudible Becomes Audible, and then later in 1971 was re-released in the Americas under the title Breakthrough. But in EVP circles, Radive is perhaps best known for having developed a number of different approaches to EVP. There was a certain science that he applied to this, and here's essentially what it had to do with. He felt that there were microphone voices where one would simply leave a tape recorder running, and there was no one talking in the room. You'd just put a microphone recording in a room, and it'd record to audio tape. But he indicated that one could even disconnect the microphone, and sometimes you'd still get these voices on electronic or magnetic tape. Then there were radio voices, which involved recordings of white noise from a radio that wasn't necessarily tuned to a station. That sounds a bit suspect to me. And then he also said that diode voices, where a recording could be made from a crystal set that was not tuned to a television station, that could also be utilized to discern EVP. So in the book Breakthrough, he outlined not only the different varieties, but also consistent observations that he'd made over the years with regard to electronic voice phenomena. He was very, very serious about this and looked very in-depth into it. And I think, frankly, a lot of the ghost hunters who are out there today who utilize tape recordings to try and monitor spirit talk, they may be woefully unaware of the research that that Rodivet had carried out back in the 1960s and 70s. And some of the things that he observed were that voices that were EVP tended to speak very rapidly, and often in a mixture of different languages, sometimes as many as five or six in one sentence. He also said that they speak in a very strange but definite rhythm, which seems forced onto them, and that finally the rhythmic mode in which they speak imposes a shortened telegram-style phrase or sentence. Probably because of this, he said, grammatical rules are frequently abandoned and neologisms abound. Now, Rodivet would pursue the serious study of EVP, and then, of course, he died just a few years later in 1974. But according to some, and this is where it gets fascinating to me, according to some, maybe Rodivet's work didn't end there, and not even death, we could assume, had actually stopped him from continuing his life's passion of the study of electronic voice phenomena. I have to point out that indeed that there are a lot of stories where people have claimed not only to have recorded weird voices, but they've also claimed at times to have received strange communications via more conventional means of communication, mechanical communication today. Specifically, as we've alluded to already, phone calls that they claim were made by people from the other side. Is it possible for a spirit to communicate using a telephone line? And can a person from the great beyond post a collect call to the living world? Is it possible?
Only if they have $1.75.
I think collect calls are effectively obsolete today.
Just do what Carrot Top tells you. What was that whole gimmick back in the late 90s? It's like,
oh God.
Dial 8. I can't remember it.
I think it was everything that Carrot Top ever said that was a gimmick. But
do we have a second to debate the EVP phenomenon?
Let's debate the EVP phenomenon, and then we're going to... Because I do have I have something to add to the conversation with regard to phone calls from the dead. We'll dig into it in a moment. But yeah, let's talk about this. Okay, EVP, yay or nay. Let's weigh the pros and the cons.
I honestly can't say either one, because the whole EVP phenomenon is so subjective in so many cases, because 90% of the time you have these sounds that you really cannot... One person will say it says this, somebody will say it's the other thing. Then again, you have to take into consideration cross frequencies. When you're on a ham radio and things like that, or a car stereo or anything, I mean, you can pick up police frequencies on a walkie-talkie. And I'm not saying completely discount. I never say completely discount. If you're in a room and you get a recording and you know for a fact that you were the only one there and it seems to be saying things to you directly, of course that's notable. And I think it's great to document this stuff and keep it on hand. But as you're always saying, like, be critical, be skeptical of it. Like, try to rule out any other interference that you possibly could before you say definitively, this is a spirit of a dead person that I'm communicating with.
Well, I think a problem with asserting that we're hearing spirits of the dead is that, again, first of all, just like I've argued about ghosts, we don't know what kind of energetic manifestation, apart from, you know, a physical body, could actually produce a voice. You know, it's a strange idea that a voice could be manifested from a spirit when there's no physical voice box, you know, there's no sound air passing through vocal cords, you know, and there's no actual resonation, you know, there that's occurring, which is physically allowing the sound to be produced. And yet people claim that these sounds of, you know, spirits of the dead are. So, and now one assertion that has been made, and actually researcher Joshua P. Warren, a friend of the program, Joshua, I don't agree with everything that Joshua says, and you know, and he and I know that, we both know that, but he did a very compelling experiment a few years ago where he took a basically kind of a cheap radio, you know, shack microphone, a little cardioid microphone, and he took an old laboratory grade copper coil and he unhooked the speakers from a stereo system and then plugged the copper coil in where the speaker output would go. So effectively, no sound was being created, but the electromagnetic information being passed from the stereo system was being sent to the coil, and it was emanating from the coil in the form of an electromagnetic field. Now, what's interesting is you can take an old cardioid microphone that essentially operates with a little coil in there, and it's resonance that's allowing this device to actually record sound frequency. You can hold that device or that microphone next to a copper coil like that that is broadcasting an electromagnetic field that, again, your ear wouldn't hear anything. And there, you know, in truth, there's no actual sound being made.
Yeah.
But the electromagnetic information being carried and broadcast by the coil will nonetheless resonate with the coil within the microphone. And when you hold the microphone up next to the coil and record to tape and then you play it back, you will hear the sound as though it were being played through speakers. So one approach to this is that maybe even in the absence of actual, you know, physical movement of sound through air, in the absence of actual physical sound at all, could it be that some electromagnetic energy could maintain what we might call the energetic signature of sound, okay,
yeah,
that could actually be interpreted by certain kinds of recording equipment? So that's one interpretation of this, but I still think that there's a question that has to be raised, and that is, if we don't know what the soul or the spirit is, if we cannot prove that there is an afterlife, these are, you know, religious and spiritual concepts, but scientifically, you know, and I'm a spiritual person. I'm not, you know, religious like I once was per se, but I'm very, very, very spiritual. And I have a background in religion and spirituality, not a professional background, but, you know, I mean, I've lived that life, and I've also questioned it just as well. And I think that's a very healthy thing to do. And so in doing so, I can say that while we have spiritual and religious notions of what the afterlife is, science has a hard time reconciling with that. And therefore, we can't prove, okay, the quote-unquote impossible with something that is unprovable. In other words, we can't prove that a ghost, for instance, is the spirit of a dead person utilizing mechanical equipment like electromagnetic field detectors or whatever else. And the reason why is because we can't prove the afterlife. We don't know how to prove if, you know, there's a soul that exists apart from the body. And to say that we can use a device to go into a room and detect, you know, the spirit of a dead person and thus prove the afterlife, you know, it becomes a bit of an argument that's really unprovable because, again, we have no way to measure what the soul is. We have no way to prove that there's an afterlife. We have no way to prove that a soul is something that is a physical, energetic signature that can exist apart from the body. You know, many would argue that these all are things that have to, you know, exist only in accordance with the presence of an actual physical body. And nonetheless, I think that the body of accumulated knowledge as it pertains to reports of phantoms, ghosts, otherworldly contact, you know, loved ones coming back in dreams, all different sorts of, you know, representations of, you know, afterlife studies, if you will, dating back to the beginning of human culture, and their pervasive presence throughout different cultures worldwide and throughout different periods of history and different interpretations of the afterlife and spirituality, that alone, to my liking, most skeptics would not agree, but I still think that that presents enough of a cultural question as to what the underlying truth may be. And so I think that while science can't prove that there is an afterlife, I'm not going to be so quick and cavalier as to dismiss the potential existence, because sometimes I do think that there are realities that can be brought to the table from religion and spirituality, but which science has not reconciled with, and therefore unprovable by today's standards, these things may still bear a modicum of truth, if that makes sense. So I think that EVP, again, is sort of that same sort of thing. We're trying to prove the afterlife, but we really have no way to say that, well, you know, the afterlife, you know, we do know it exists, and now we got to try and find out how.
Well, I mean, it goes both ways, because the scientific community can get locked in there. Like, if it's measurable by the bounds of science as we understand it right now, then it should do this, and it should seem to us as this, and that means that quantifiably, this is not a spirit of the dead, or this is a spirit of the dead, you know, and a lot of people utilize their kind of, I feel something, I feel the energy, or their spiritualism, or whatever they tend to call it. But people tend to get locked into that tunnel vision of whatever it is that they believe, and they don't look at the outside possibilities of how to quantify that. And I always use this analogy. Before we understood electricity, electricity was magic.
Oh, of course.
We did not know what that was. And who's to say that scientifically right now today we understand everything, because we find new species of animals all the time. We find out something new about our universe. We're always proving the Higgs boson every other week exists.
I know, and that's the thing. It comes back to the same argument that I'm always making, which is that, you know, at some point, talking about religion, a lot of people don't like this, and I don't mean to mischaracterize the, you know, people in academia or whatever, but science is religion-like in that rather than being an ever-growing and a living, you know, body of knowledge that we use to apply to the study of, you know, physical nature around us, many look at it more as a set of immovable laws, you know, a set of commandments.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, in other words, you can't, if you veer outside of this, then it is impossible. And I don't think that that is good science any better than to presume that there is an afterlife, and now we're going to prove it. We have to prove the afterlife before we can find, you know, evidences of something, again, that is unprovable. And you get into a lot of these philosophical problems when you start talking about ghostly phenomenon. But again, I don't think that that removes the possibility that ghosts exist, or maybe even that spirits of the dead could communicate from the great beyond. It's just, how do you prove what the great beyond is?
What we're missing is an experiment that is reproducible with similar results time after time after time. I don't think you can outright prove the existence of the afterlife, but I feel that there might be a time or a discovery or something along those lines that allows for an experiment based on that sort of hypothesis to be reproduced and tested again and again. And maybe there you might gain some information to further extrapolate or plant. That's the whole thing. You have to have a design that meets the criteria set out by the scientific method and other scientists and researchers on different levels.
Yeah.
That's why there is no there's no meeting of the minds there, because everyone's, it's a risky business, you know, and it's a big money business.
Well, yeah.
Why study that when we can make some pills to put the kids on, you know, or.
Well, that's a good point. Nobody typically brings that up.
Messages
but,
into your head. How about.
Yeah. The thing is if it's something that can, UFOs are very similar. And then I want to get back to EVP, but I'm just going to make a brief, allusion to UFOs. The Condon Committee back in the 1960s, that was their whole reasoning for not endorsing scientific study of UFOs, because Ed Condon and his you know, people there at the University of Colorado UFO Project, they had said that they felt that there was nothing to be gained from the scientific study of UFOs. The same reason that there are known treatments that have been shown to shrink cancerous tumors, but they can be produced so inexpensively that there's not enough of a market to warrant there being an industry put behind it. If somebody can't profit from curing someone else's cancer, then they're not going to do it.
It's just like in the realm of therapy, biofeedback has shown time and time again to have actual working results that are very, and here's the key point, cost-effective.
Yeah.
They're extremely inexpensive and it actually works. Instead of pumping pills and prescriptions at people, they don't talk about biofeedback. They don't promote it because it's not profitable.
I sat down with a doctor the other day, you know, and I asked them what they thought about biofeedback, and her response was, "I'm a big fan of drugs." Oh, no doubt, no doubt, no
See,
doubt.
See, I can say this because I've done biofeedback. Yeah. I saw the results, and it was awesome.
Yeah, when you were a teenager, you actually had that happen. And so, but anyway, bringing this back to ghosts and hauntings again, you know, if we study the science of the afterlife, you know, maybe a serious, as Tyler pointed out, maybe a very good reason why there's not a more academic interest in that is because it's not something that could be overtly profitable, you know? And if it's not something that people can, you know, immediately profit from, maybe it's not worthwhile. And yet, Konstantin Radovi spent the last years of his life seriously, perhaps madly pursuing it. Okay, now, let's bring this home. Okay, Franklin, North Carolina, literally about an hour away from the bunker where we are right here. There's a gentleman named George Meek who lived here, and he was, of course, well known for his use of what was called the Spirit Comm machine. I actually had a good book about George Meek a few years ago, and I lent it to a friend and a fellow researcher and never got the damn thing back. But all that to say, George Meek was an interesting character because George, again, claimed that he had been utilizing a machine called the Spirit Comm, and along with a well-known, well, at least in his circles, psychic by the name of Bill O'Neill, the two claimed that they were using the Spirit Comm to record voices of the deceased. They'd claim to be in touch with, for instance, a deceased NASA scientist and all sorts of other things. Well, this is really interesting. In at least one instance, George Meek also claimed not only to have been in contact with a voice of a deceased person. George Meek also claimed to have received a phone call from one of these deceased people. And at that time, George, because of his interest in EVP and spirit communication, had been very, he'd been well prepared, and he'd begun to record phone calls and things that were happening, so, you know, for personal reasons. So on the morning of January the 27th, it was 1994, Meek was at home, and he had begun to record a phone call that was coming in. And I'll be damned if the phone call, when it arrived, George answers the phone, as you're about to hear because we have audio here. George answers the phone, and the voice identifies itself as being none other than the deceased Konstantin Rodovy. But let me just point this out. If this is indeed real, I don't know why spirits of the dead have to sound quite so creepy. Decide for yourself. This is the alleged real phone call from Konstantin Rodovy, a good 2 decades after his death,
listener's
to George Meek.
Discretion advised.
Yes, listener discretion is advised. Here we go. Here's that audio.
Morning, this is George Meek.
This is Konstantin Rodovy. George, my friend, at last we succeeded in contacting you. Janatis beside me, and she wants to give you all her love. This is Konstantin Rodovy. This is the first contact you get from us. I suppose that you can hear me.
I can hear you very well, very plainly.
Fine, so this is the beginning of a new story, a new chapter, George. You are a very good friend of ours. Even if we haven't met, we will continue this. This is the first bridge we succeeded to build to the States. Mark was contacted, and I must interrupt now.
Thank you, dear friend. You may not be able to hear me, but I want to take this occasion to say...
And then the call ends. Okay, so that was allegedly a phone call that George Meek received.
This is John Constantine.
But, I mean, really, it sounds like, Henry Kissinger, you know, after drinking all night the next morning and smoking all night. If spirits of the dead are contacting us from the afterlife, they certainly sound creepy. Now, of course, naturally, and Caleb's over here rolling his eyes, a lot of people...
I'm not rolling my eyes. I was leaning back into my chair to channel.
I see.
But no, I do have things to say about this, but I'll let you go first.
Well, I'll just say this. That's the audio. We're going to allow our listeners to stew on that one for just a moment. And when we come back, believe it or not, there's more to this story, which will be the final segment of this week's edition of the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay tuned for that. More on this perplexing and frightening piece of audio you just heard. Was that the voice of a dead man calling George Meek in 1994? We'll discuss that more when we come back. For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact,
Every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Grayling Report, the final segment of this week's edition of the program. Now, the folks in the chat room appear to be genuinely creeped out.
I think that was your comment, Micah.
Micah says he is genuinely creeped out. Oh, no.
Everybody else is like, meh.
Yeah.
Sounds like my Furby.
But folks... Folks have asked that I play that again. Let's hear the voice of Constantine Rodive from Beyond the Grave once again.
Morning, this is George Meek.
This is Constantine Rodive. George, my friend, at last we succeeded in contacting you. Jeanette is beside me, and she wants to give you all a love.
Now, I want to point something out right there. What is being conveyed to George? George, apparently his wife had passed away right around that time, and the voice claiming to be Constantine Rodive was actually saying, your wife is right here by me, and she wants to give you all her love.
By the way, the body I was taking in the spiritual realm is a baked potato, and that's why I have to talk like this.
Well, okay, I heard that and I thought somebody was pulling George's leg, but it turns out that another researcher, Mark Macy, who actually I had corresponded with Mark a few years ago, Mark had also claimed to have been contacted by the same voice, same man, and there were a couple of other researchers, EVP researchers and the like, who also claimed to have been contacted. So there were a whole slew of people who claimed that they were in touch with a person claiming to have been the late EVP researcher making a phone call from the dead. Now, here's where it gets even stranger. My first reaction, and perhaps to an extent, this is still my feeling, is that somebody was pulling all their legs. And then this gentleman by the name of Adolf Holmes comes into the equation. He's another researcher who had been studying communication from the great beyond, and he had claimed around the same time that he received an odd message in German language, but this had not been a phone call from anyone claiming to be Constantine. It had been in the form of, get this, according to Holmes, a message that appeared apparently in like a text file on his computer, but he said the computer was not connected to the internet. The computer was only connected to a printer and plugged into the wall. And when he opened it, the German language message read, "This is Constantine Rodive via the devices at Station Revenich. Dear colleague Adolf Holmes, I herewith confirm my own contacts with Mr. Malkoff, another German researcher, with Mr. Meek and Mr. Macy in America. More contacts have been made successfully in China and Japan by telephone and fax. Our tests are necessary because humanity is in a state of being created by themselves, which is negative for us to a point that we cannot influence consciousness. We therefore ask you on Earth to open the psychic barriers to a greater extent. Only then is there a possibility for us to proceed with more contacts via radio receivers, televisions, and computers. Unfortunately, messages from our side by telephone and fax do not suffice to make clear to humanity our reality as one of many realities." So, if that story is to be believed, Holmes had claimed that that was actually
found on his computer, and that the computer hadn't been coming, you know, hadn't arrived by email or anything like that, that the computer that it appeared on was not even hooked up to the internet. Now, granted, I think that it's not beyond the possibility that people might just make things up just as well, but it's a very perplexing and strange mystery. Is it possible that people could have actually been involved in some sort of a hoax? Was it a hoax, or was there actually evidence here that suggested that an individual known to have been deceased for 20 years had been contacting various researchers who had been interested in electronic voice phenomenon and had actually reached out from beyond the grave to try and touch base with them? We've only got just about a minute left, but, you know, Tyler brought up something very interesting during the break, and that's that much like SETI research, how is it that you were wording it? Just like the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, we expect that aliens are going to contact us, but we kind of do the same thing with ghosts.
I was just playing with it in my head. It's, you know, we know that NASA spent a lot of money and a year sending signals out into space, radio signals, but it's easy now to accept that that might not be the best way to relay communication or receive it with the possible ETs mm-hmm. or life out there. And the same, I feel, could be applied to the spirit world or beyond our reality. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the EVP. I don't discount it. I don't put too much, you know, faith into it either. I enjoy hearing genuinely intriguing samples, but it's like all the good stories of ghosts and everything have to do with something like, oh, you find a note that seems to correlate a feeling you had about someone who's passed. There's always a very interesting way that these people seem to contact their loved ones, and that makes them very interesting. The EVP, being the EVP itself, takes a very interesting sample to really catch my attention.
Oh, absolutely. Likewise. You know, and I've heard some interesting ones over the years, but unfortunately the clock has gotten us. Who says time doesn't exist? Apparently does in the bunker. And so on behalf of Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, and of course Dick Oakley, the mouth of the Graylian Report, I'm the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, and you've been listening to another week of the Weird, Wild, and Wonderful. Tune in next week for more of the strange, the unusual, and sometimes also the creepy. You can email us in the meantime at info@graylianreport.com. And signing off for this week's edition, I am Micah Hanks. As always, my friends, stay strange out there.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylianreport.com.